Welcome to Health or Consequences, Commonwealth Beacon's podcast series devoted to healthcare and public health issues in the state of Massachusetts. I'm Paul Haddis from the Lown Institute, here with my co-host, John McDonough of the T.H. Chan Harvard School of Public Health. We're recording this the second week of March, and we remain as a state in the health policy arena, very much still focused on Steward Healthcare, its financial challenges, and what might ultimately flow from it. John and I have written about that subject, and Governor Healey has also, amongst others, spoken out about it, noting the need to protect patients first. But sort of second to that is the concern about the workforce at those Steward hospitals, especially if the threat of either abrupt closures or the system not making it potentially comes into being. So John and I thought that a good way to get into the issue of the workforce, which includes 15,000 or so people employed by Steward, is to speak with Julie Pinkham, who's really in some ways I would call the dean of the healthcare union world, you know, in our state. The two major unions at Steward are Service Employees International and then the Mass Nurses Association, which Julie has been the executive director of for a little over 23 years now. MNA has 25,000 or so unionized members of the state, of which 3,000 of them are currently employed at Steward hospitals. Welcome, Julie.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let me get us started. Your unions had a long history with Steward Healthcare System. Can you talk a little bit about that? Relationships from its origins, even a little bit through the Cerebras and then the purchase by Medical Properties Trust, leading up to today's crisis. Can you share with us a little bit of that history and what you've known about the challenges facing Steward over these years, the financial challenges?
Sure. Obviously, our relationship started off a bit bumpy in that we'll say the original four. We were in contract negotiations for St. Elizabeth's, Kearney Hospital, Good Samaritan Hospital, and Norwood Hospital. Those contracts were open at the time that the Caritas was indicating that they were really in financial distress and they were looking for new ownership. That all sounds vaguely familiar. And we were right in the thick of negotiations. We ended up obviously settling those contracts, but not without a bumpy bit of a fight there. One of the issues, ironically, was the nurses had long wanted to establish a Taft-Hartley defined benefit pension plan, because it's something, as you know, in a lot of the male-dominated unions, defined benefit Taft-Hartley plans are not uncommon. And as women, you know, we just, 401ks are okay, but we tend not to do that well with them because the high-earning years tend to be the years that women are having children. And so it just doesn't work out as well. So we really felt that we wanted to establish one. We were looking around and it had already been a discussion at Caritas. And so it was bumpy for a number of reasons, but that was one of them. But we did walk away with an agreement to establish a Taft-Hartley plan there, which we thought would be beneficial for all. After that, as you know, it sort of expanded because Caritas ended up becoming Steward under Ralph DeLaTorre. And then there were a number over the years of, I'll call them low-hanging fruit, if you will, in which other hospitals that were in financial distress were being acquired by Steward. So for example, Quincy Hospital, Morton Hospital, Holy Family, Haverhill, Neshoba, St. Anne's had already been part of the mix as well. So the expansion by Steward was really looking at financially distressed hospitals and adding to them. And I think that speaks a lot to the health policy issues that were going on in the state that had been going on since the 1990s when the state deregulated healthcare. And I think, you know, Ralph had made it very clear that he wanted to expand the system beyond Massachusetts. I mean, his idea was to have a system that was national. And actually, beyond that, he went to international levels. So Cerebras got into the mix early on as a cash infusion. And I think that was, you know, somewhat tumultuous because it was helpful in one hand, but problematic in another. It was certainly helpful because cash was desperately needed. So they were in equity that was coming in with a lot of cash on hand. And I think at that time, the attorney general was trying to make sure that if the transaction was going to occur, which not everybody was too enthusiastic about, but there didn't seem to be other alternatives readily available. I didn't see any very wealthy nonprofits swooping in at the time. And so it was either you lose these hospitals, you do something different. And everybody, I think, said, okay, we're going to allow something different. So Steward was formed. He got Cerebus in. It was a lot of, I think, roughly $800 million made available. But if you recall, part of that was monies to go towards the pension funds of the Caritas hospitals because they were under a Catholic system. They're not protected by the PBGC, which is a pension benefit corporation that insures pension plans. So there was no protection for all of those employees, and I mean everybody. Whether
those hundreds of billions of dollars of unfunded liability that had to, in essence, be covered at the beginning. Yes.
Yep. And there was some concern, you know, we had already seen in a couple of states where some Catholic institutions had indeed not managed that, and a number of people lost their pension plans. So I think there was a desire to make sure that didn't happen. So a good portion of the funding that was coming through Cerebus was to shore up those liabilities and so people wouldn't lose their pensions. And I tie that into because of our fight for the Taft-Hartley pension plan and ended up sort of intersecting with that issue slightly later, which I'll talk about. But so Cerebus was in the mix. We had some fights over the creation of the pension plan, getting it established. We ended up merging it with a Teamsters pension plan that was having in the red, a small one, and creating the nurses and IBT 813 pension plan. I mention it only because the way that we created it was we pulled in the legacy plans. So those legacy plans that were funded by Cerebus, we pulled into our pension plan. So we pulled into it along with it, $540 million into the pension plan and take responsibility for administering, oversee those legacy plans by agreement with Steward. And we wanted to do that in part because those are our members too. Some portion of those legacy plans are our folks. So best to keep them protected to make sure their pensions were intact. Fast forward, as Ralph was trying to expand the system, I think this is really where, from our standpoint, we got very nervous. And that was in 2016, when it was clear in order to get additional monies and to expand the system, Ralph entered into an agreement with Medical Properties Trust, a real estate investment group that essentially focused on hospital healthcare institutions. And in doing so, when he sold the properties to MPT, and actually, ironically, in our state, it was MPT and another group called Macquarie, which is an Australian REIT that actually does, I think, longer term roads, bridges, and those types of things. But they, you know, another REIT. And so the infusion, I think, was over $1 billion. And then it appeared shortly thereafter that the expansion was underway nationally. And there was some international expansion too in Malta and a number of other locations. I think that made us really nervous, not, you know, whether he wants to expand or not. What made us nervous is, you know, for-profits generally in our experience aren't necessarily long-term players. And they tend, you can wake up and there's a transfer of ownership, but with MPT in the mix, the real estate investment group, the property was no longer owned. There were no assets anymore. The only real assets that Steward had were the people working there. You know, frankly, the people delivering the care were the assets. So if there was going to be new ownership or any transition, we became very concerned of how that would actually be accomplished. And I think we voiced those concerns to a number of different agencies at the time that this was a really different funding source and mechanism that we had seen in healthcare, and nothing that we could see in hotel industry and others, but not in healthcare.
The official sort of media coverage of the Steward financial challenges following all those expansions only been the last couple months. But you and your union members aware of it before that time?
Oh yeah, we were aware of it in 2016, and we had discussions, you know, frankly, with the Attorney General's office and a number of people just to say, as we'd go over other issues, we would raise the issue, this is different. Is anybody a bit concerned about this? And how exactly would this work? You know, in the end, if there was any transfer of ownership, how exactly would that play out? How did they see that working? How did they see oversight? I don't think anybody really had any answers. And as always, there's a number of issues going on at any given time. So I don't think it got the necessary short, you know, attention of anybody.
But there's been reports, for example, that vendors haven't been paid now going back a year or two. And I want to, you know, bring John into this conversation. But were your nurses working in those hospitals aware of those kinds of challenges happening for the individual hospital system?
Yeah, I mean, they were reporting it out. We bring them to the local facilities. I think the supply issue really escalated in the last probably year and a half. That was very clear that there was something going on, because in the past, I would say, you know, not just Steward, but other for-profits, we find tend to not have a lot of robust supply on hand, and people aren't particularly happy with it. But in this case, it was different. It was, you know, the normal course of business, a cancellation of surgery because the equipment that you needed in the OR for, you know, knee replacement wasn't available. So nurses were like, what is going on? Raising it.
So Julie, this is John McDonough. Thank you for joining us. It's great to see you. There, in the public mind, there's a personification of Steward in the form of Ralph Dellatore, the chairman and the CEO, who's been involved since before it was Steward when he took over Caritas in 2008. And he has become almost in some ways a cartoonish character with his yachts and his huge jets that the company purchased and his other behavior in Malton and elsewhere. Did you work with him closely? Do you know him well? Do you have a sense of the guy? And how culpable and blameworthy is he for this dilemma now that the system finds itself?
Yeah, no, I did not have a one-on-one sort of relationship with Ralph. I mean, there were probably maybe three or four meetings during the course of time here where we would directly be in the room to discuss whether it was related to the initial contract negotiations or the pension or subsequently on reimbursement matters, but probably very few. Our relationship is much more at the local level. You know, obviously in meeting Ralph, I think most people would say what you'll get from that meeting is that you know that he's extremely intelligent. He's very charismatic. I think, but you know, those are the good qualities. The down qualities, I think what you'll hear from folks is he definitely gives off a vibe of dissent is not tolerated. You know, I think he had an idea for a large expansion plan that, you know, I guess could best be maybe stated that he got out over his skis a bit too far and lost mission and purpose. And I think that we are paying for that now. But I have said this before, and I will say this repetitively. 15 years ago, we had this problem. None of the nonprofits came forward, and there was no plan in place health policy-wise to rectify it. Subsequent to that, we have seen other hospital closes, not the least of which North Adams Regional Hospital closed with 72 hours notice. So I guess I sort of say, look, we invited this in. When we deregulated in the 90s and we subsequently didn't create any sort of guardrails, we invited it in. So if we don't like what we see, we should probably look in the mirror and take some responsibility for what we have. Because at the end of the day, it's health policy. And if we don't like it, then we need to change it.
So Julie, what are you hearing today from your nurses about what's going on inside the Steward hospitals as they're being ready for sale? Maybe not all of them will make it in the world to come. We don't know. But what's you hearing on the ground?
You know, obviously everybody's deeply concerned. These are folks that have worked at these institutions and lived in these communities for a very long period of time. So they're sticking with the hospitals. I think I give them a tremendous amount of credit. You know, in the environment where nurses are highly sought after, we have not seen a rapid and mass exodus. Rather, we've seen a commitment from folks, and that's everybody in the workforce, not just the nurses, not preferred, but everybody in the workforce. They're really sticking at these institutions. And they're very, very hopeful that there'll be a transition of ownership. I think as far as how the environment is to work in right now, DPH, obviously, as you guys are probably aware, have monitors in the buildings. And there's a lot of oversight right now over the system. So I think that has helped the scenario. And there was an infusion of cash, if you will, from a recent transaction of Steward that helped alleviate some of the vendor issues. So, and it's being closely monitored. So that situation has improved. But I think everybody is really waiting, as we all are, for, okay, we're humming along. We're trying to make sure we deliver to these communities, but we're not in charge of what's going on over our heads here. So where are we at? Where's the light at the end of the tunnel? Are we going to see a transaction of these institutions? And I think everybody's hopeful that those transactions will be local and nonprofit for the future.
Any thoughts about the medical group, which is the most valuable asset Private Store owns in the state? Any thoughts or hearings you have about that?
Yeah, I think that's a general concern that I have. On the one hand, I feel like I'm back, you know, this is Groundhog Day, right? We're back again, you know, where we started, whereas we sort of justify why we want to get this infusion of cash in a manner that isn't necessarily a manner that we like. So on the one hand, I feel like sometimes are we playing checkers and others are playing chess? So we're focused on the, you know, the hospital industry and the crisis in front of us. And meanwhile, in order to resolve some of those cash issues, are we going to see an expansion of the physician network as for-profit, as well as a number of other healthcare sectors moving towards private equity and for-profit? So are we watching our flanks, you know, or are we just going to substitute one problem for another quickly enough?
So, Julie, what do you think right now, if you talk to them, and I assume you do, but what should Governor Healey, Secretary Walsh, and Attorney General Campbell be doing right now? And do you have any sense one way or another of their game plan and how they are seeing this and where they're trying to bring this to?
Yeah, I do think that they are trying to be very communicative with us because they certainly understand that if the workforce exits, there's nothing to transfer to, right? And that's the physicians, the nurses, the rest of the workforce. The fact that they are standing pat is the only reason why we have any hope for a transition. That said, I think that it's an awkward scenario, as you know, because it's a private sector entity. And, you know, this is the problem that we have post-1990 deregulation. I think there's not been a mechanism in place that they feel comfortable with bringing the parties directly to the table. And frankly, that's exactly what we need. So I think they're trying to keep the lines of communication open, but that's not necessarily as helpful or fruitful as direct communication as the parties are potentially looking at suitors, if you will, or new owners, because I think that the communities, the folks that are working at these facilities really should be involved in the process early on. Otherwise, they're in defense again, where you something's being done to you, not with you or for you. And I don't think that's been a very good recipe for decision making. I mean, I understand antitrust is a concern. But I really frankly wish we could find a way around that concern to put some of the players in a room together. I don't want to wake up in the morning or get a call before a news release that, hey, these hospitals are being sold to. And then we are going, okay, well, can you answer me this, this, and this? All the questions for the good people that have actually put themselves out and hung firm with the institution versus if you brought us in early and we're able to say, this is what we're looking at, and we can relay. Well, here are some of the concerns that we would have. Is one group going to buy a set of hospitals only to close one other? Are they going to close certain services? You know, I think in fairness to the people that are delivering to the care to the communities now and the communities that they're in, I think that's been a huge part of the problem all along since the 90s, is everything has been reactive, not proactive, whether it's healthcare planning for the state or just any delivery of services or closure of service, always reactive. And that just has not bode well for anybody.
Bob Kuttner, the writer for American Prospect, has taken a look at this situation along with some other people and come out and said he believes that there is strong potential of criminal liability here that should draw attention from the federal government, the Department of Justice, and or the Massachusetts Attorney General. Do you take those ideas, those accusations seriously? Do you dismiss them out of hand? Do you have any sense of whether or not there may in fact be some criminal liability here that should be investigated?
I don't know if there is, but I certainly think that if there's any concern for it, it should be investigated. I don't think anybody should walk away if there's a concern. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, as with all manner of things, whoever is in charge is accountable. And I do think they'll peel back the layers of this onion and find out, you know, what went on when. And I think it's probably, whether you want to lay blame or not, it's probably necessary just to be able to perfect, if you will, or improve upon health policy going forward. I think we need to know what happened, when it happened, why it happened, what the problem was before we can effectuate a good plan going forward as well, so it doesn't happen again.
In that regard, you mentioned deregulation in 1990, the ultimate evolution of have and have not sort of not nonprofits, where Caritas Christi was a not a well-resourced institution, but at the time that it couldn't make it, none of the more resourced ones were going to come to the floor to help figure out a future for it. You pointed the concerns of for-profit entry of Steward, you know, as a private equity, and you've raised a concern about maybe the physician group sale to another for-profit, whether private equity or Wall Street-based. All these things are going on in the state. When you sort of step back at a broader health policy level, what should we be thinking about, and maybe what the legislature ought to be doing in light of all of these things that you've observed?
Well, short of enacting single payer, which in the long term I think is the most rational approach, short of that, I think, number one, I don't think we have a good assessment of healthcare needs in this state. You know, in the last, I think, reimbursement legislation, there was actually, I think, a plan to do a health assessment. I'm not quite sure that anything ever actually got accomplished or done effectively from it. But I don't understand why it is we wouldn't want to do a very good analysis of the state, its growth pattern, where we expect the needs to be, and then make a plan from there. You know, I guess if you were to parse it out, you'd say, we need to take more of a public health perspective on our policy when it comes to healthcare than we do a business perspective. And right now, everything's been on a business perspective. And then we're shocked when, you know, things aren't going well because it's not profitable to have certain, you know, maternity's not profitable. Oh, okay. How many different maternity services have closed now? So, and we're seeing deaths as a result of it. I mean, it's just not tenable. So I guess I would first like to see a very good assessment, which we are more than capable of doing here in this state, about what the public health needs are across the spectrum of the healthcare delivery system. And then effectuate, start talking about policy and plan to fund it and to hold it accountable. Haven't seen that happen yet, but yet we keep running around trying to increase reimbursement with no plan about how to really make a difference in the delivery of care. You know, what was the infamous quote in the 90s? It was Senator Burke, I think, said, put the scorpions in the jar.
And see who comes out alive.
Nobody.
I was there when he said it.
I mean, I think the answer to that is nobody comes out alive, right? So I think it's good to take the scorpions out of the jar and maybe put some public health policy in the jar instead.
Well, I think you recall, Julie, and I certainly recall because I was there. If you go back to the 1970s and 80s, we had in Massachusetts robust regional and statewide health planning and organizations tasked with doing that work and doing that analysis. In the late 80s and early 90s, we made a choice as a state that we are going to let the magic of the marketplace work in terms of defining our healthcare future. And if you look at where we are right now, it seems like you can draw a pretty solid line between the deregulation and the deplanning decisions of that era with where we are today. Does that sound right to you?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, frankly, I think that policy at the time, if you recall, I think there was a Robert Wood Johnson study that said, for example, that Worcester was the second most overbedded area of the state compared to the entire country. Because I think at one point they had like 8 hospitals in the Worcester area. I think it's got 2 now. You know, the reality is that there was a fundamental belief that with managed care, there was going to be less need for acute care beds, and therefore we had too many beds and we needed to close the beds. Well, what particular legislature or community group wants to come out and say, close my hospital? You know, it wasn't going to happen. So I really feel like a lot of it wasn't about market competition, delivering high quality at low cost and no change in access, none of which came true. But I think a lot of it was a lack of willingness to make hard choices when public health assessments may indicate, as a result of changing population or dynamics, certain services or certain institutions weren't needed and others were. Like, we might look at it to say medical, surgical, acute care hospital needs might have diminished, but did behavioral health needs go up? You know, and rather than address that directly, and, you know, potentially train staff appropriately ahead of time so that we could redeploy them, make available in certain institutions, we instead, you know, just, oh, we're going to close that, it's not profitable, and then bam, let's put a for-profit behavioral health up, and maybe long-term behavioral health's not as profitable, so let's go with, you know, short addiction issues. You know, I mean, that's what we've got. It's not a really big surprise that it doesn't really work well in terms of actually delivery of healthcare.
So, Julie, some people are suggesting that perhaps this is an opportunity to take a more regional approach rather than selling off the Steward hospitals to a single buyer, if that turns out to be a possibility, rather than that, split it up and really do some regionalization of healthcare services, bringing together acute hospitals, nursing homes, home health, community health centers, and other parties, areas like in the Lawrence area, Lawrence General Hospital, down in New Bedford and Fall River with St. Anne's and South Coast. And I hear you say we shouldn't let antitrust considerations get in the way of that kind of system rationalizing. Am I hearing you correctly in terms of that being a direction that you think makes sense?
Yep, I do. And I think that it should be done with an understanding that we don't want even small systems to articulate they're doing it for one reason, only to find out that they make other decisions later. So I do think there has to be accountability. If you create a small system of adding one or two hospitals and then close one of the existing hospitals, I think there needs to be a very upfront discussion about what is you intend to do. I also think, for example, to the point of looking at healthcare needs, the Health Policy Commission can be an enormous asset right now in taking a look at where are the patients. So many of the EDs now are actually the resource of patients being admitted into the institutions. You know, the old sort of way of making a plan for elective surgery, I think we're seeing a lot of more admissions coming through the emergency department. That's not a good thing, but it is just a reality. So we have the capacity to look at the emergency departments throughout the state and determine what zip code are these folks coming from, and then try to make a rational plan on need based on which systems match up with need based on communities. I mean, we can look at a number of different things. We can look at the South. I think that I had read previously that if you look at the largest population growth, it was happening on the South part of the state, as you know, old cranberry bogs are being sold for real estate and there's a plan for a train heading down to the South. But interestingly, the South part of the state is the only place that we don't have any tertiary care center, right? So you'd sort of say, okay, well, if that's going to be a huge growth factor, where do folks that have tertiary care needs go in that sector? And what part of the planning is that? And I think the last part of that, I would say, you still need to make sure that the reimbursement is fair. And right now, we already have an unbalanced system. So you're going to have to deal with that. You know, I don't think we're too far down that path not to have to include that in the discussion, how you rectify that problem. I think Maryland got it more right than we did in terms of their system. I think I have the last rate setting book from 1986. I think I kept it as a memento of I'm going to look at this again and say what happened. And I can go through the entire book, which lists every institution, every unit, every bed available, and see what happened over 30 years. And it's just amazing. People have long forgotten the names of the hospitals and beds that used to be available to them.
So final question, Julie. The legislature is examining the involvement of private equity in healthcare in Massachusetts. If there were a proposal put forward to ban private equity in healthcare in Massachusetts, would you support that?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
I mean, if there's a dollar to give a shareholder or elsewhere, that's a dollar more that could have been spent on something more helpful in healthcare needs. And I think, you know, we desperately need those dollars.
Julie, on behalf of Paul Hattis and myself and Commonwealth Beacon, thank you so much for spending time with us today. This has been a terrific conversation, and good luck in all of your challenges and your great work with the Mass Nurses Association.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. Let's cross our fingers that in the next few months we have good news.
Let's hope. Thank you.
Take care.